Good evening and welcome to City Visions, broadcasting tonight from our new 9 p.m. Wednesday night time slot. For those of you who may not be familiar with our program, we are KLW's live call-in radio hour that focuses on local Bay Area issues and ideas. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we hope to answer some of your questions about COVID-19 in the Bay Area. To start, we are lucky to be joined by two guests who have been deeply involved in our community's response to the coronavirus outbreak, one reporting and one working on the front lines. I'm pleased to be joined by phone, of course, by Erin Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome, Erin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by Dr. Peter Ching Hong, a medical educator at UCSF, who specializes in treating infectious diseases and also a colleague and friend of mine. Welcome, Peter.
So great to be here, Pache.
And so we ask you listeners to be patient with us as we're trying something new, doing live radio, but not just live radio, but radio by Zoom. And of course, we want you to join our conversation tonight. We know you have lots of questions for our guests. So we'll give you our phone number now if you'd like to ask questions of Erin or Peter about the COVID-19 pandemic and how it's affecting the Bay Area. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Erin Alday, I wanted to start with you. Gavin Newsom's been on the news quite a bit these days, talking about how California has flattened the curve. And there's lots of things to be excited about. But is it too early to be excited about how things are going here in California compared to other parts of the country?
The answer to that is yes and no. It's too early to be excited. I think that to start on a positive note, we certainly are seeing that our efforts, our shelter in place statewide is working at this point. I think by now in the Bay Area, we're almost three weeks in, and the state is a couple weeks in, and we're saying, you know, it's definitely had an effect. The numbers are slowing down. We're still seeing increases, but they're not nearly what they were before. And we're clearly not on a path like what they've seen in New York and some other places in the country. So that's fantastic. And I think that everybody is finally starting to acknowledge that some of these very cautious public health folks, and including Governor Newsom, are recognizing that now and acknowledging that it's working. We're on the right path. So that's wonderful. And we should all feel good about that. I think, you know, we're still in for a long haul here is the issue. You know, the nature of having slowing things down is that it's now going to take us a while to get out of this, to get through this kind of flattened curve. So, you know, we've still got a ways to go. And the other issue is that, you know, there's so many unknowns with this pandemic, with this coronavirus, that we can't say that we're not going to have issues in a week or two or three. I mean, this thing can come out of nowhere and spike up again. It could still, you know, see this surge, see this sort of overwhelming of our hospitals. And so we're certainly, you know, our health officers are advising us to still be very careful about getting too optimistic that, you know, we're definitely not out of the woods yet, to use a cliche.
Right. So yeah, this is an interesting concept, Peter, that I'd like you to address, this idea of flattening the curve. Everyone's been talking about that, but that once you do that, you perhaps lengthen the curve in the sense of it taking longer, as Erin says, to get out of this. Explain to us how that works and why this is the better way for things to go.
Totally. The main idea about flattening the curve, and everyone's using that phrase a lot, is that you spread out the disease so that your resources in the healthcare setting or the hospital setting in particular in the ICU is in step with the demand that we need or that people present us with. For example, if you have 10 ventilators and you have 100 people coming in, that's not a great situation. But if you have 5 people coming in and you have 10 ventilators, of course, that's going to be great. The reason why it's prolonged is that due to many factors, but the main idea is that disease transmission is still occurring in the community, but at a slow rate. You're not stamping out disease for multiple reasons in the US in particular, because of lack of testing. It's like, you know, if you only HIV tested those who had PCP pneumonia or coprocarcinoma, but not everyone in the community, disease transmission can still occur, but it's substantially reduced when people maintain social distance and they wash their hands and do some of the things that the public health folks have been telling us to do.
So I saw some numbers in the Chronicle just published this evening that California had the highest number of deaths in one single day. I believe it was 51 today. We crossed a threshold of 500 deaths total in California, and the highest number of new cases in one day, coming in at around 1,472. Should we be concerned about this, Peter, that the number is actually continuing to go up while we're hearing from some people that our ability to shelter in place is actually helping?
I have a lot of strong ideas about that, Pache. I think, first of all, California is not a country, even though we'd like to think so. And our borders are porous. And the second thing is we don't have good disease screening at the borders. So in other words, every plane coming into California from a surge city, say New York City or New Orleans or Detroit or Milwaukee, it's like a bomb full of coronaviruses waiting to explode in California. So although we might be doing well as a people, we are at the behest of the states around us who may not be doing so well.
So what does that mean for policy at the state and local level?
It means that we just have to wait for the others to do something that's consistent with what the guidelines have been like. And there are several states that are not doing anything, and I continue to feel a little bit pessimistic. Of course, as you know, Pache, I'm a glass half full kind of person, but even I have guarded optimism. I'm really psyched about what we've been doing here in the Bay Area, in California. But again, with a patchwork response to a virus who doesn't care who you are and what state you live in, it's not a great situation.
So, Aaron, have you heard anything in your reporting that speaks to this issue of how the limitations of what people in the Bay Area and California can do when we are still open have open borders? Is there any way that governors are trying to work together to try to address some of these issues, especially with neighboring states?
I think they're trying to do some of that with peer pressure, to be honest. Certainly, California folks have been talking a lot about how well shelter in place is working here, how that's reflected in our numbers. You just have to look at other parts of the country to see that we were really on top of things. And there's really been that sort of pressure to have other states that maybe aren't seeing or think that they're not seeing, you know, the numbers yet, for them to get their acts together now, you know, and get an early start on it, just like the Bay Area did. Because we were doing shelter in place before our numbers really took off, when I think a lot of people were surprised that was happening. But you just have to look around and see that this thing's kind of lurking, you know, it's out there spreading before you can really necessarily see it, just giving the testing issue. So I think it's partly that sort of peer pressure idea. But also, I think the people I talk to, they're less concerned about what's happening right now. You know, definitely our borders are porous and there's that. But there isn't, you know, nationwide, there's not a lot of travel going down. I think I read today that air traffic at San Francisco International, it was something like 5% of normal. I mean, people are not traveling right now. The big concern is what happens when we are ready to ease out of this shelter in place and sort of try to resume some sort of normal life, and people get maybe more relaxed. And that's when California will be potentially very vulnerable. And if you have travelers from other states, from other countries coming here, you can sort of ignite a fire again real easily, especially if we don't have the public health resources in place to tamp those down.
Speaking of vulnerability, I want to talk about the populations that have been looked upon as the most vulnerable, older people, people with chronic diseases or immunocompromised. We saw reports of outbreaks at Laguna Honda and a residential care facility in Orinda. Is this something that's growing, Peter? Do we see that this is taking off in those areas despite the things that we've been trying to do?
Certainly, from the Chinese data, and we looked at more than 3,000 patients even before it really came to the Bay Area to kind of get a handle on who was most vulnerable. And sure, we've seen the age range of people who are going to die and the comorbidities like cancer, heart disease, hypertension, diabetes. But really, I think what has taken off, I think beyond that and beyond our even darkest fears has been the issue of race and ethnicity. And I think the headlines today from New York City releasing their race disaggregated data really made a lot of people pause and think about how does race ethnicity intersect with some of these comorbidities? And is our country and our disparities in health really going to be accentuated now that COVID-19 is here?
So say more about that.
So people might have seen some of the early reports from, particularly from Detroit, Milwaukee, Chicago, some of the counties in New Orleans, and with actually some very precise data from New York City coming today, showing that per 100,000 age-adjusted population, using age-adjusted analyses, the rates of deaths, we're not even talking about infection, which is a matter of access to testing, deaths is 22 or so in Latinos, about 20 in African Americans, compared to about 10 in the general population. So about double the risk if you're African American or Latino. And that's certainly borne out locally, because I know from my colleagues at San Francisco General that they, even before this data came out, have been seeing a lot of people who didn't expect to be sick. So these are younger, they are generally minority populations, and there were people who probably couldn't afford to adopt shelter in place as early as the general population. These were people who couldn't afford the luxury of staying at home and working, and we're riding in the buses and on muni without necessarily protection. So those were some of the people that my colleagues were seeing at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital.
And how do you square that, Aaron, with the reports in the Chronicle and then just this evening by Gavin Newsom that, in fact, in communities of color in California, that we're not seeing a disproportionate number of cases or deaths when it comes to Latinos, Black African-American or Asian-American Californians, although notably whites and Caucasians are way underrepresented, but those other groups are not overrepresented. What do you make of those numbers?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And I thought it was interesting today. I listened to Governor Newsom's briefing that he seemed very wary of releasing these numbers. I got the impression there's been a lot of pressure on the state and counties to release this demographic data for obvious reasons, for all the reasons you just talked about. But, you know, the governor himself said that they don't have a lot of that data. So what they were releasing under pressure was only about a third of all the cases that they have in California. It is very preliminary. There's a lot of room for maneuvering, and a lot of big cities and counties aren't part of that data. And of course, they're going to have a lot of the communities of color that will be part of that. So all those kind of caveats aside, the cases that we're seeing are sort of reflective of the population, which suggests, you know, there isn't that disproportionate effect on communities of color. But, you know, Los Angeles has released some of its data, and they certainly are reporting higher deaths among the African American community in Los Angeles than the communities represented, I think about twice as many. A lot of our Bay Area counties haven't released that data yet. I think San Francisco is the only one, and even San Francisco has not released all of the data for its cases. Weirdly enough, part of the problem is that the death data is the most reliable, but there aren't that many deaths in the Bay Area, which is a great problem to have, obviously. But because the numbers are so small, a lot of counties are hesitant to release demographic data because of privacy issues, because when you have small numbers, it's not statistically significant. So San Francisco, for example, only has 10 deaths, and, you know, trying to assign demographics to that isn't necessarily going to give you a good reflection. That's not necessarily representative of what's happening in the community. So it's the whole demographic thing is it's complicated in California. And I think it's a shame that we're not seeing this data sort of released quickly and in real time. Because I think that if we had, you know, say Alameda County, which has Oakland in it, reporting its demographic data of all cases, that might be informative, but Alameda County is not reporting that yet. It's not clear why they're not reporting that. I think that there's just been, my sense is this has been a very dynamic situation, very challenging for these counties, and they don't have a lot of this data. And so they're kind of having to go back in time and look up individuals, look up cases and sort of trace this data back. If they had been collecting it all along, we would probably be seeing more of it right now.
Peter, do you agree with that idea that, you know, we just don't have a complete data set? It's still too early to tell. So the numbers are really hard to interpret. Or should we be ahead of this and giving out this data as quickly as we can get it?
Totally. I totally agree with Erin. I mean, as an epidemiologist as well, you know, because I like numbers. When you have a lot of deaths, which is what New York City is, you have more precision about how it affects communities of color or how it affects various populations. I agree with Erin that when you don't have that many deaths, it's just like your p-value. You can't really distinguish between what's happening in one group and the proportions versus another group. So I think the fact that we've been successful in California will also make it very challenging to interpret disaggregated data.
All right. So on that note, something to keep watching and to make sure as the data comes in that we are aware of how this epidemic and the ways it has hit different communities is showing in that data and telling us what we may need to do in terms of policies and support for those communities or parts of our community that are most hit. I want to turn to this issue of information, right? So we're an outlet of information tonight. There's the Chronicle, there's Gavin Newsom's daily briefings. Peter Chin Hong, there's your Twitter feed. Do you help people understand where to go to get their information that is the most accurate and and without getting totally overwhelmed? Like how would you give people advice on where to go and how much to consume in any one day?
That's a really tough question, Pachi, and one that I was really not prepared for. In every other epidemic or pandemic we've had in the United States, be it H1N1, Ebola, you name it, in the past, we've always relied on the CDC and a central voice based on science and to tell us what to do. I guess we kind of got sort of like lulled into this sort of you say and we do, you say jump, we say how high. But in this epidemic, it's been a little bit challenging. And I think as clinicians, first of all, we weren't hearing a lot of guidelines, or it seemed like it was muffled from the top. And after the first briefing or so in the CDC, we noticed that there was a little bit silence, actually a lot of silence. So we began sharing information amongst ourselves, and we used Twitter. So you know, that's how it first started for me. I was sort of reaching out to my colleagues around the country. We would sort of like share stories, information. We'd interpret the data coming in from the rest of the world. And how did it apply to us? And I think what was the aha moment was when we at UCSF started sort of posting some of our clinical guidelines or like how we got investigational drugs, and we would put it on Twitter, and suddenly like hundreds of people would like it. And I was like, OMG, what's going on here? Not that I didn't want to be popular. I always like tried to be popular before, and for some reason it never happened. I mean, I'd tweet like, you know, inspirational messages on Friday feelings, and maybe a few people would like it, and maybe my mom or something. But then suddenly in this era of COVID-19, it went, these minor things that we would decide on as a clinical group here went like wildfire across the country. So I thought, wow, that's really strange. And then the second phase was even stranger to me, where people from the community would then ask me questions on Twitter and I'd respond. And suddenly like a lot of people would engage with me. So Twitter not only became information sharing, but it became dialogue for me. And as you know, you introduced me as a medical educator. What brings me a lot of joy from day to day is distilling really complex topics into very bite-sized pieces for people who didn't necessarily have that background, usually first-year medical students. But it's very much the same approach I took in the community when people would ask me questions. And it gave me a lot of satisfaction to like sort of boil down how the virus travels and what's the main promised land for the virus, which is the mouth and the nose, and how we shouldn't be worried about doing everything when we should just be focused on one thing, which is to protect your mouth and your nose. And of course, wash your hands. So those kinds of things help me out.
Great. We have a couple of emails, actually. One is from Tanya saying, why is California lagging on testing? What's California's plan for testing for the virus and testing for antibodies? So I think, Erin, maybe you'll take that first, and then we'll see if Peter has something to add.
Sure. That's the complicated question of the moment. Why did California lag so far behind in the first place? And how is it going to pick up? And, you know, the frustrating truth is that we just don't know. There's a whole bunch of reasons that play into that. Starting with the CDC having its issues getting the tests out to all the states, which has been just a problem across the board. I mean, I think people are well aware of that by now. But California then continued to lag even after the CDC got out there. And it's really, you know, there's a lot of people that kind of have theories, but I don't know that we have all the answers yet. I think some of it has to do with there's been a heavy reliance on this commercial network of laboratories, which is, you know, they're all stepping up, these commercial labs and academic labs, and it's wonderful they're all stepping up, but they're not necessarily, you know, prepared for the level of testing that we needed to do. And then, you know, so they've had to try to ramp up, you know, with staffing and their own resources and just having the space, like the physical space to do all these tests. And then on top of that, you know, these supply shortages that just keep coming up. I mean, everything from the swabs to the reagents used, just kind of across the board, we keep missing things. But none of that, to me, fully explains why California seems to be somewhat unique in this situation. And we keep, you know, we're pressing on this, but I kind of get the feeling that, it's this chaotic situation. I don't know who even has the answers at this point. You know, I think it's just there's a lot of pieces to this puzzle that we're still trying to tease apart. And it's, you know, this is hard stuff to cover when it's actually in motion and you're trying to get answers. So, you know, that's definitely something we have whole teams of reporters that are assigned just to cover that particular issue, and they're working on that. And then moving forward, you know, we're certainly seeing progress. You know, we're seeing that these serological tests are starting to kind of get approval and hopefully be out there. And that would potentially tell people if they've already been infected, and, you know, if there is indeed immunity from that, then maybe they can go out and about and be okay. I tell you what, as much as we need testing right now to get a sense of what's happening in our communities, it feels like with the shelter in place situation, you know, we're kind of stuck where we are. We're going to keep monitoring the case counts and hopefully, you know, seeing the numbers get better and better, seeing our hospitals not be overwhelmed and come out of this. At this point, I'm a little more concerned, and the folks that I talk to are more concerned about what happens again when we come out, and we are going to be heavily reliant on abundant testing, very quick testing, to be able to monitor the situation, to detect, you know, cases before, you know, as soon as they come out, before they can become fresh outbreaks. So I think, to me, that's a big issue, is we need to have that testing situation fully resolved before we can really come out of this shelter in place situation. And so that's sort of where my personal attention is focused. And that's where a lot of our reporters are focused.
Peter, we have another email that follows on that from Robert saying, what data do we need to see to relax our stay at home restrictions?
Totally. I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I completely agree with Erin. The U.S. dropped the ball on the test. The WHO gave us the test. We said, no, let's do our own, and then they can do it. So then local labs started to do it. So what data do we need? It's actually pretty simple. We need to know how many people in the community have it. And if you have it, we quarantine them. And then the other people who don't have it can go around doing their own business. But because we are operating in a black box, it's kind of hard to figure that out. And again, as Erin was saying, we built up the capacity. Now at UCSF, we can do 4,000 tests a day if we wanted to, but we don't have something simple as a swab. And it's not a Q-tip, it's a special swab. So I think one creative thing that one can do is to learn from other countries. Some of my colleagues in Hong Kong have been using early morning saliva, so you can get away from using the swab. And I think I've been encouraging our group to validate those tests as an alternative testing strategy. But again, serology, as Erin was pointing out, might be another test we can use, although they need to be validated. We don't know how long antibodies will last and how long you'll be protected, whether or not they're picking up more than one kind of coronavirus. all those kinds of issues need to be sorted out.
So as we wrap up this segment, it sounds like there's some cautious optimism that the shelter in place that we've had since March 17th is helping to stem the tide and not overwhelming our acute healthcare there. But there's lots that remains unknown. And so we just have to stay put literally and figuratively and keep waiting for more information and for other resources to catch up, to be able to give us the data we need to be able to understand how to move forward responsibly. So I want to thank my guests for this first segment, Peter Chin Hong from UCSF, a medical educator there and an infectious disease specialist, and Aaron Alday, a health reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks for joining us, and we look forward to having you join us on future Wednesdays to keep us up to date.
Thank you so much for having us.
Welcome back to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. In the second half of tonight's show, we'll be focusing on how COVID-19 is impacting the nonprofit organizations in our community. The orders to stay at home have left some nonprofits slammed by increased demand and fewer volunteers, while other nonprofits have had to temporarily close their doors, cutting off crucial revenue. To discuss the challenges these organizations are facing and strategies to keep them alive and vibrant during the crisis and beyond, I'm pleased to be joined by Paul Ash, Executive Director of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank, which is continuing to provide food to vulnerable populations throughout this crisis. Welcome, Paul. All right, we'll see if we can get Paul connected. Are you there?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, welcome. And we're also joined by Jan Masaoka. She's Chief Executive Officer of the California Association of Nonprofits, a statewide policy alliance, and the voice for California's nonprofit community. Welcome, Jan.
Thanks. Hi.
So I wanted to start with you briefly. Can you give us a sense of the role of nonprofits, not only in the service scope, but also in the economic engine what they provide to the economic engine of California?
Yeah, I appreciate that question because, as you know, nonprofits are kind of hidden in plain sight. You know, everybody knows PBS and they know Sesame Street and they know the school they went to and they drop off their daughter at Girl Scouts. But what people don't often understand is kind of the whole nonprofit community at large. And for example, here in California, one in every 14 California jobs is actually at a nonprofit organization. So we're really, you know, an economic powerhouse as well as kind of the service providers and cultural providers that I think we're familiar with. And I think that the economics of California's nonprofits are really showing up in this crisis, both as strength, our ability to step forward like Paul Ash and the food bank system has, but also, as you mentioned, so many organizations have completely shut down and are suffering because they had opening night has been during the coronavirus or their annual fundraiser or all the people that typically come into their preschool. So we're just seeing just dramatic impacts on this very large economy.
Mm. And so I saw some numbers. We're talking about 1/6 of our GDP. Is that right?
Yeah, about 15% of our state domestic product, our state GDP, absolutely right. We actually have, you know, an interesting thing. We have about 90,000 nonprofits in California, but over 2/3 of them are all volunteer organizations. Mm-hmm. So that all volunteer doesn't necessarily mean small. Just take a look, for example, at Alcoholics Anonymous or Youth Soccer Leagues. Those are huge organizations helping huge numbers of people, but they are all volunteer. In addition to California's workforce, the equivalent of 431,000 full-time jobs are contributed by Californians who volunteer. So I think volunteerism is one of the things that is really unseen as an economic powerhouse, and it's one that's really suffering right now because it's just impossible for many volunteers to continue to volunteer as they have.
Right. And 1.2 million workers that are on the payroll, right?
Right, 1.8 million, and that's more people than live in a lot of states, I want to point out.
Right, right. Paul, according to the Washington Post, over 10 million Americans applied for unemployment benefits in March, with 6.6 million claims in the last week of the month alone. How has demand for your services increased in the last 4 weeks? And how has the San Francisco Marin Food Bank been able to ramp up?
Well, we've seen demand increase steadily and significantly. We've been trying to throw up new ways of distributing food. We call them pop-up pantries or new spaces where we hope to serve between 500 and 1,000 families every single week. And you know, we know these are folks we haven't seen in the past. I volunteer with my family on weekends at a drive-through pantry, and you can tell when you load the food into someone's car. You'll see tools there, a tool belt, other things that these folks were working just several days ago, or at least a few weeks ago, and now all of a sudden they find themselves without a job.
And so you're managing to innovate in the way that you're distributing food. How about your supply chain? How's that looking?
Well, for the next few weeks, our supply chain is good. This happened to hit us at a good time when we happened to be fairly flush in our inventory. As that dwindles, we're going to have to go into the open market and purchase more food. And we have some concerns there. You know, we've all seen it in our grocery stores. There's been something of a run on food as people no longer going out to restaurants or cooking at home. They're worried, so they're stocking up more. And the markets are in a little bit of turmoil, and that needs to settle down for us to be able to go into the markets and, for example, buy eggs. It's a staple for our distributions.
And so how are you keeping your employees safe, and are you having any volunteers right now besides your family members?
Well, we discussed that a lot, that pull between safety and service. It's a line that you walk. To be completely safe, you stay home. If you stay home, you don't serve people. So we're trying to do the best job we can at keeping ourselves safe and make sure we're out there to serve the people that we all work in these organizations to serve. So there's a tension. On the volunteer side, we've had to cut down in the number of volunteers that we can have on site at any one time. We know we need more distance, so we're not working shoulder to shoulder anymore. We've put up a large tent in the parking lot just to give us more space so people can do the job and do the work that we desperately need and be safe.
And Jen, what are you hearing from other Bay Area nonprofits? How are they faring? Whether it's parts of the state or business scope or size, how are they doing?
Well, it's huge differences, I think. As you mentioned earlier, there are some nonprofits that are simply overwhelmed. You know, just a few days ago, I talked to the CFO of a San Francisco-based primary health care clinic. You know, they need to have at least 50,000 masks a month. The price of masks gone up from 40 cents to a dollar. Now today, you know, it was announced that they have some new sources for masks, but, you know, they're seeing staff members get sick. They're having, and they're overwhelmed with people seeking testing and also people seeking care. So on one hand, we see that, and there are now some important government supports. I think San Francisco County has really been a leader in providing the supports to nonprofits like those on the health, on the front lines. On the other hand, you know, we see organizations that have, you know, the exploratorium, the theaters, the churches, many child care centers, these have all closed down, which means that they have zero revenue. So it means that they're letting their staff go, they're not able to pay their rent, and, you know, not everybody's going to be able to come back from that, but there is this kind of dichotomy between people that are overwhelmed and people that are just kind of in a crushing void right now. But, you know, I think that there are some important benefits now that are coming from government, or at least being promised by government. And a big difference from this between the last recession and the 2008 period is was that at that time there were a great many helps to small business in the recession that were not made available to nonprofits and are really a victory for advocates we've been working over these last years since then is the fact that nonprofits are included in many of these same things like small business loans and payroll protection loans because many nonprofits are small businesses. You know, we have fewer than 100 employees and we have the same concerns of needing to pay people and needing to pay the rent.
Right. In fact, the Wall Street Journal reported that COVID-19 is ravaging nonprofit organizations' finances as the demand for services increases and Feeding America, the nation's largest network of food banks, of which the SF Marin Food Bank is one of its affiliates, has projected a $1.4 billion shortfall in the next 6 months alone. So, Paul, what does the ledger look like for the SF Marin Food Bank going forward, and are you concerned?
Well, right now, we're fine. We're going to be good through the next few weeks, maybe the next few months. I think a lot of this depends on how long the economic impact lasts. If this is something that goes on for months and months and months, and we have lines stretching around the block, with cars and with individuals for an ongoing period of time, that's when I begin to worry. Because infrastructure-wise, you know, we don't send out a tax bill to people. We depend on people's, you know, good hearts and minds to keep donations coming in. So I think in a situation where this goes on for longer than we've ever experienced before, that's when I begin to worry.
And Jan, how are other nonprofits that you're hearing from, how are they responding? How are they innovating either in their abilities to continue bringing funds in or operationally, given the impact on their staff? How are they managing to stay afloat? What are they trying to do?
Well, we're seeing a lot of creativity and much of it technology-based. So, for example, Freight and Salvage in the East Bay, they don't have performances. They can't have performances now, but they are able to maintain a lot of their classes by doing them online. So the teachers online and the students are online. Now, because there's a lag in the technology, they can't necessarily play together because the Internet's just not quite fast enough for that, but nonetheless, it does make classes possible. Of course, a lot of preschools are trying to do some online programming, but I think then almost everybody has canceled their fundraisers, and they're trying to have kind of virtual fundraisers, but they're not getting the same kind of response as they do when people are looking forward to going to an event that they have bought a ticket for. So I think we'll see that a lot of those kinds of technology-based innovations continue, but of course not everything can go online. Because a lot of what nonprofits provide is a sense of community, and if you go to church or temple, there's something about being with people that's different, for example, than just watching somebody talk to you online. That's certainly true when you're going to see the theater or seeing a counselor or taking a class or many of the other things that nonprofits are able to do.
This is City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the impact that COVID-19 is having on the Bay Area. And in this segment, we're talking about Bay Area nonprofits. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, you can reach us by phone at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions at KALW.org or tweet us at CityVisions KALW. So, Jan, I wanted to dive in a little bit deeper about the CARES Act and how you said earlier that what was great about the CARES Act is that it's actually including nonprofits, perhaps as other stimulus packages have not in the past. So tell us a little bit more about the features of the CARES Act and how they relate to nonprofits and what supports they can get from it.
Well, I think we're talking now about people that are not looking for the funds, for example, the same way health clinics and and affordable housing, people housing, you know, homeless housing and food supplies they're talking about. But sort of nonprofits are not necessarily emergency providers, but nonetheless are very important. And the, probably the one that's getting the most attention right now is the Payroll Protection Program, PPP. And this is the one that starting Friday of last week was going to be giving forgivable loans that you could use for payroll if you had fewer than 500 employees. And they announced it was going to be first come, first serve. And so you can imagine a national torrent of people trying to apply first thing on Friday morning. And the whole system just failed, to tell you the truth. So first of all, people had to apply through their banks. And not all banks decided to do it, to participate. And most banks decided that you could would only be eligible to apply if you already had an account with them for several months and if you had either a credit card or an outstanding loan from them. So there were many people, nonprofits and small businesses, that were really surprised to hear these brand new criteria and felt really left out. And I think it's been such an embarrassment to the federal administration that there's talk now of having to provide more money into that fund and make the guidelines clear and tell banks that they can't just service their best customers. So I think that's the one that's getting the most attention. There's also another program for people that have 500 or more employees. That one's not forgivable loans, but it nonetheless will hopefully tide people over. But I think, I mean, I still think everybody's reeling. For example, payroll protection, they had started out, talking about meeting your payroll for the next couple of weeks at least, and then they started talking about it being less. And just this morning, they started announcing, not in a very clear way, but we started hearing from the Small Business Administration and bits and pieces that they're only going to talk about lending people $1,000 per employee up to 10 employees. So really that, you know, $1,000 doesn't keep somebody on your payroll for very long, and it's not going to do a great deal towards, you know, both helping the people that are getting laid off from nonprofits as well as nonprofits who need to sustain their work so that they don't fall apart indefinitely.
How about incentives for charitable donations? How could that potentially help, or is that really not going to help at this stage?
Well, it's going to help a teeny tiny bit. Unfortunately, you know, the Tax Reform Act of a couple of years ago resulted in, you know, it used to be that about 30% of Californians itemized on their taxes, which means that they could pay less taxes if they gave to nonprofits. And that federal act in 2018 meant that only 10% of Californians now get to pay less taxes by making charitable donations. So what this does is it gives people, even if they don't itemize, the ability to deduct $300 from their taxable income, as long as they still have to demonstrate that they made $300 in donations. So we definitely think it's a good signal, and it says something about the importance of people continuing to give. But at the same time, the person who gives between $100 and $300 is probably not highly motivated by this pretty obscure feature. And it's especially, I think, but it is important because we do know that, in particular, the lower you are on the income chart, the bigger percentage of your income you're giving to nonprofits. So it's certainly a good thing, but we're going to have to rely on people's good hearts and their feeling, understanding of the cause of keeping nonprofits alive and in service to their communities more than we can rely on this tax deduction.
And there are community relief funds like the Oakland COVID-19 Relief Fund and the Silicon Valley Strong Relief Fund. What's your take on those?
Well, right now, everybody is telling us how much they've raised, and we're hardly seeing anybody tell us how much they've given out. So we want to see what happens there. And we also want to encourage people not just to give to those funds, but also give directly to nonprofits. Give directly to the nonprofits that you've always known. Many of them are emergency service providers in mental health and housing and domestic violence. But many of them are very important organizations, you know, environmental organizations, climate change, animal shelters. that also really need help during this time. So give to those, but also give to these. And then if you don't know who to give to, then give to these funds.
And so what would be on a wish list, your wish list, the wish list of other nonprofits to see on the agenda of policymakers when it comes to coming up with packages to sustain nonprofits in the weeks and months ahead? What kinds of things would you like to see?
Well, this is going to sound a little technical, but one of the most important ones is letting people have more flexibility in their contracts with government. So, for example, you'll see a senior center that has always had, let's say, 300 people for lunch. And they get paid by the federal government for how many lunches they are able to serve. Well, they can't do that anymore. They're able to do a very few amount of delivery, but they're not able to meet their numbers. It's really important for organizations like that to still get their contracted funds because they still need to keep their staff. They're still paying rents. They're expanding their ability to deliver services. But we can't let them just die out. It will be impossible for us to get them back at a later time. So contract flexibility is probably number one. The second thing is the same kinds of things that other people are seeking, which is payroll support, support to people so that we don't have to lay them off, and support to people who are unemployed because so many millions of nonprofit employees are now unemployed. So those things. But I think more than anything, I think, you know, what we need is, you know, is probably the same things that that Peter, the doctor on your previous segment, was talking about. What we all need is we need testing, and we need the ability to try to have standards that we can keep for longer than a couple of weeks. Because even if we get all the funds we need to stay open for another month, that's not going to be long enough.
And Peter, Paul, excuse me, I wanted to end with you on this segment. So many of us want to be personally on the ground pitching in, but we can't due to social distancing. How can our listeners get involved and help out? Is it just writing a check at this point, or are there other things that people can be doing?
Well, it really is. Some of the traditional things that people can do, and you mentioned volunteers who are in a protected health group, they can't and shouldn't come down and volunteer. But we're also not doing food drives simply because we don't have the volunteers to process that kind of food. So we really are down to the point where the most efficient and effective way to help is in writing a check and donating money so that we can do our job, we can go out into the market and purchase food, we can keep trucks running, we can rent those tents for the parking lot so volunteers who can come out have a place to work.
Great. Oh, and one last thing, Jan, I understand tomorrow morning at 9, Cal Nonprofits is hosting a webinar for how nonprofits can take advantage of Small Business Administration loan programs.
Yes. We have two people from the Small Business Administration from SBA who are going to be on the webinar. It's actually at 11 o'clock, though, and it's free. We already have 1,700 people signed up, but you can see it for free. You can get the link on our website, www.calnonprofits.org.
All right. So I want to thank my two guests for this segment as we wrap up the focus on nonprofits, Jan Masaoka, Chief Executive Officer of the California Association of Nonprofits, and Paul Ash, Executive Director of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank. Thanks to both of you for the good work that you do, and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph.
To close out our program tonight, we are introducing a new feature. We're going to have an arts piece at every part of this hour at the 9:50 mark, as it were. And tonight we're starting with Flash Fiction. We're really excited to debut this feature with a local author, Sarah Ladipo Manyika, author of the books Independence and Like a Mule Bringing Ice Cream to the Sun. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
So before we hear the piece that you wrote for us tonight, which I'm so excited to hear, I haven't seen it yet. Can you share how you felt being asked to write a piece of flash fiction centered on the coronavirus?
Well, I think, you know, like everyone, our worlds feel upside down, and it's hard both practically and emotionally to focus on our jobs. And for me as a writer, it's taken me some time to sort of get back into writing, and I still feel like I'm trying to figure out what I'm supposed to be writing and how to write. And
if you'd like to make a call,
can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, sorry. I was hearing something else. So
it's Flash Live Radio.
Okay, all right. And so when I was asked to do this, it felt at first, you know, I felt a little. Is it on my end? Sorry.
No, you're doing okay.
Okay, all right. Sorry.
One of our guests who hung up.
So at first, I felt a little bit like, oh, you know, will I be able to do this? But I have written something, and you know, I think as a writer, I am often thinking about how to step into other people's shoes. And so as I have been thinking, reflecting on the situation and occasionally going out on a walk to, you know, to get foodstuffs or to have a little bit of exercise, I found myself walking around and putting myself in different people's shoes that I come across. And so that was sort of the impetus, the inspiration behind what I eventually wrote.
All right. Should we just go ahead and hear what you came up with?
Sure. So I've called this piece Tricks. Your mom is on Zoom. Your Uncle Abdul is on Zoom. And you just had class on Zoom. But now school's finished and you want to go outside and play with your friends, Brian and Gabriella. But your mom says no, it's not allowed. And now she's yelling, quit jumping in your room. We're trying to work. You're making too much noise. And it's not fair because they're making even more noise. They're like all the time on conference calls, talking, blah, 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 blah. There's nothing for you to do except watch TV. This really sucks. You stand by the window and you stare across the street over to the park where the sign says closed. And you hate that sign with the pictures that say it's okay to go running, biking, hiking, and enjoying nature. That's so boring. You want to play on the swings, the slide, and the climbing bars. And you want to play tag. But nobody plays tag 6 feet apart. What's the point? You hope the park guy will come take that sign down. Or maybe if other kids just start playing there anyway, then you can go too. You'll say, hey, look, everyone else is there. And you'll tell your mom, don't worry, I'm not going to get sick. And because you're trying to think of every way to solve this problem, you don't notice the old lady who has stopped to look at where you're standing. She sees you in your warrior's hoodie with your sad, sad face. The next day, the same old lady walks down your street again. This time, you're not standing by the window, but she thinks you are. Because before she actually looks up, she sees someone else waving and smiling at your window. Turns out it's your cat that the other person is waving to. But your cat wouldn't have noticed her either because he's too busy watching all the fat birds out there squawking more loudly than usual. You're downstairs in the garage, moving boxes and other stuff around to make skateboard ramps. And because you've opened the garage door to give yourself more room, you see the old lady as she's walking back. This time, she sees your tricks and she smiles. Nice. Just as your mom yells, what are you doing? You're going to scratch the car. And that's the end of that.
Oh, how lovely and delightful. And just to capture the anxiety and some of the boredom and some of the isolation that we're all experiencing right now.
Mm. Yeah, and I think it's true, absolutely, the isolation. And also, you know, how we are still trying to make connections. And so for me, the woman in the story kind of looking up and trying to make that connection with the child is also a part and parcel of, I think, what we're going through.
Do you think this time of sheltering in place will be a rich source for you and other authors? Or is this going to be something that will fade?
That remains to be seen. I think for me, I'm just most excited by what I'm already seeing. You know, people are writing a lot, and I'm already seeing just incredible pieces, and that is heartening and encouraging. I think it's also, at least for me as a writer, it's a time when I find myself turning to those writers that I consider to be greats. You know, so for me, someone like James Baldwin, and Baldwin described his role as a writer as being a witness. And that's always been a real inspiration to me. And so I try and see my role as trying to bear witness as best as I can. And that means listening deeply and carefully and, you know, writing just when and as we can.
Sarah Ladipo Manyika, Bay Area author and the intrepid flash fiction writer for our first foray into this format. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I want to thank all my guests for joining me this evening. At the top of the hour, we had Aaron Alday from the San Francisco Chronicle, Dr. Peter Chin Hong from UCSF. In the middle, we had Paul Ash from the San Francisco Marin Food Bank and Jan Masaoka, Chief Executive Officer of the California Association of Nonprofits. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kdlw.org. Our engineer this evening was Dilip Latulip. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Chris Nooney. And I want to give special thanks to KLW and the entire City Visions team for being so flexible in adapting our show to our current reality. Join us next week as we explore the topic of distance learning under the coronavirus. As we end the hour, we would like to honor the musician Bill Withers, who died last week at the age of 81. I hope we can all find some inspiration in his music during these challenging times. For all of us here at City Visions, this is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Have a great week and be safe.
Till I'm gone.